On today's episode of Relative Currency,
physicians really take a lot of loans in order to do that education and then really have a delayed time in actually building their wealth because of how much education and training it requires to become a physician. So the average physician has over $200,000 of medical student loan debt. So, I mean, that's, you know, a mortgage right there.
Brother, sister, and cousin, we've been relatives for a while. We're chatting about financial things. We're doing it family style. Cryptocurrency, stocks, and loans. Financial literacy. It'll be that and so much more on Relative Currency.
Currency, fine-tuning financial literacy for the middle class.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Relative Currency. I'm Frank here with Alicia, and we're so glad you could join us. As always, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Google, and all other major podcast platforms. We have a treat for you on this episode today, a special guest. You know, I don't want to say anything that would kind of give it away. I'm going to let Alicia come in and just introduce a wonderful guest that's going to really share a lot. I think a lot of great information that you're going to have to go back and listen to at least two or three times to get everything. It's going to be a wonderful, episode. So without any further ado, Alicia, please introduce the wonderful guest we have this evening on Relative Currency.
Good evening, everyone. I am very excited to have our guest. And I believe she is the only guest that we've ever had who has summited Mount Kilimanjaro. I'm referring to Dr. Elizabeth Jian, or better known as Dr. Elisa. She is the owner of Grow Your Wealthy Mindset and a board certified ophthalmologist and fellowship trained oculoplastic surgeon. She started learning about personal finance and investing while she was attending medical school. She started with stocks and bonds and expanded into real estate. She now helps others gain financial literacy through speaking engagements, hosting the Grow Your Wealthy Mindset podcast, and coaching individuals looking for personalized support. Thank you so much for being here with us tonight, Elisa.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Dr. Elisa, I'm excited to have you be a part of the podcast as well. And I was just kind of amazed, and you'll forgive me for this because my sister is also a doctor, and I just always assumed that, you know, when you hear the term doctor, that just feels like, oh, you're already rich, you're already wealthy. So what, you know, led you to, you know, the where you are being, you know, where you are with the Grow Your Wealthy Mindset, the podcast, the books, all the things you put together? What happened to where being a doctor, which most people would consider, you know, who are maybe listening to this podcast, say, oh, that's a, you know, great career. You don't have to do anything but just, you know, go to work and everything falls into place. What was lacking that caused you to basically up your financial education?
Well, sadly, I actually think that during medical school, there was this idea that, oh, as a doctor, you make so much money that money will work itself out. But physicians really take a lot of loans in order to do that education and then really have a delayed time in actually building their wealth because of how much education and training it requires to become a physician. So the average physician has over $200,000 of medical student loan debt. So, I mean, that's, you know, a mortgage right there. And it takes 4 years of medical school. I actually did an MD PhD, so that was an additional 4 years. And then residency is a minimum of 3 years, but a lot of times residency can extend to being up to 7 years if you're going to neurosurgery. And a lot of times people also do fellowship training, which can be an additional 1 to 3 years. So I didn't start practicing as an attending until my mid-30s. And if you compare that to someone who starts working straight out of undergrad at age 21, like my sister, I'll never catch up to her. And she makes more than I do as a physician at this point as well. So And there's really no way to catch up in the sense that she went from undergrad to working right away. Her master's was paid for by her company that she was working for, and she has continued to grow her income and been able to invest the entire time through her company-sponsored retirement plans, as well as, whatever else she does. And her income has also grown all this time, such that even as I became an attending physician and finally finished all the training, she was already making more in salary, not to mention her bonuses and stock options by the time I got there. So there is this perception, I think, that physicians are rich and wealthy and make a lot of money. And there are some physicians who do make a lot of money and have built wealth, but there are actually a lot of physicians that really don't have the kind of wealth you think they would have. And in fact, there was a survey done by Medscape back in, I think, 2019. They don't do it every year, where physicians reported their net worth. And 25% of physicians age 65 and older have a net worth of under $1 million after practicing for an entire career. So, taking a step back, I started my financial literacy journey as a medical student, and I did an MD-PhD program, which on average is 8 years. And I did that in Cleveland, Ohio, which is a relatively low cost of living city, as well as I grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland. So there are actually, at that time, a lot of the people in the MD-PhD program would actually buy their own personal residence, either buying a condo or actually buying like a single family home. This was back when, I mean, your dog could get a mortgage, right? That's what caused the 2008 crash, was that it was super easy to get a mortgage. And so, yeah, like on a stipend of $20,000 a year, you could go get a mortgage for a house for that was, $100,000 plus dollars. So a lot of people did that. And I was actually married, so that made it easier because my husband, well, he actually wasn't working by t at the time we were looking at buying a house because he was still looking for a job, but he had the potential to find a job and start working and have income. So it was in that process of kind of looking at like, oh, do we buy a place and starting to learn about mortgages. And back then there was all those different crazy mortgage products. It's not like, these days we really just think of getting a 30-year fixed term, and that really grew out of 2008 and all, everything that happened at that point. But
All right.
I went from learning about mortgages and all these different mortgage options to learning about personal finance to investing, and that's really where it started.
Do you feel like, as you were growing up, did you come from a family that talked about money openly or discussed concepts like net worth? One of the things that Jay and I have reflected on and we've talked a bit about on the show is that we really weren't raised to talk about money openly, not so much because it was a secret, but just because I don't perceive that there was truly a strategy in terms of building wealth. Money came in and money went out. And the goal was to have more money come in than out, but it wasn't a goal that had really any kind of sophistication to it, and didn't really have a long-term strategy of any kind. What was your family background in terms of your attitude towards money and building wealth?
Yes, so I grew up in a very middle class family. My father was a professor at Cleveland State University, and my mother, when I was young, was worked there. There was a company, they had a franchise with multiple other families. So like we had bought into this franchise called MicroAge that sold retail computers, and then she had left that and started her own computer business where she sold computers to other businesses and set it up for them. So like a small business entrepreneur situation. And we did talk about money to some extent in our household, not on the end of like net worth or investing for retirement or even investing really at all, but at least in the terms of like the value of money. There was a lot of like money doesn't grow on trees. Like you have to be frugal, you have to save. And one thing that we did do was at some age, I'm not exactly sure what age, if there was anything we wanted, like if I want a new bicycle, we'd have to go half and half. So we'd have to find a way to make money to pay for half of it, and then our parents would pay the other half. And so ways to get money from that might be saving money that we got from my grandparents or actually going out and working. So I very young started babysitting or raking neighbors' leaves for money or walking people's dogs for money. Like my sister and I would, go around like with flyers or talking to neighbors, like what can we do to make some money? So we did really get a sense that you have to make money, you have to work hard, you have to save it. We had bank accounts and we knew that money was going to the bank. When you had to save for college, that was important, that college was expensive, but you have to go to college. And so you need to save money for college. So there was talk about money, but not necessarily the bigger picture in terms of investing or retirement or what stocks and bonds are or any of that. Though I will say that when I graduated undergrad, my dad or mom were, I'm not sure exactly how the conversation went, but they're like, okay, you're done with college now. You need a, you got your first job. And my first job was actually just working as a lab tech while I was applying for medical school. And they're like, you have a job now, so you have to open up an IRA and put money into it. And you can open up at, like Fidelity. So I was like, okay. So being a good kid, I went and opened up a Roth IRA at Fidelity and put, whatever money into it. But I had no idea what that meant. It just sat in cash. Like I didn't realize you had to invest it until I started reading about money later as a medical student.
Ah, okay.
Well,
Well,
that's
that's
awesome.
fascinating.
That's amazing. We're here with Dr. Elisa Zhang, PhD, MD, a physician and life coach of Grow Your Wealthy Mindset. Again, if you want to listen to this episode or any episode, check us out, Relative Currency on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, all the major podcast platforms. Dr. Elisa, I wanted to ask you a question. I understand, being in, you kind of did a gave a very, very thorough answer of, how you got into finance, but when you're encountering other doctors, do you ever get resistance from doctors that feel like, hey, you can't be this much into finance and also be a good doctor? You have to kind of pick one or the other. How do you balance that perception, or have you met resistance to people who are, when you're trying to kind of share your kind of life coach, financial business, kind of mixed in with your practice? How do you balance those things personally, and then how do you deal with any opposition that you may have come across when people may have voiced any I guess disposition to that?
So I will say now as an attending physician, I don't find that. I find a lot of doctors are like, God, I wish I learned about this earlier. This should have been taught to us. No one ever tells us anything about all this. We take out all these loans and we don't know what to do with it. But I will say that since I started learning about this during medical school, I talked to my friends in medical school about it, and there was resistance from that standpoint. There was like, oh, why are you so worried about this? Like, we don't really make money right now, but we're going to make plenty of money later. Like, we'll be able to pay off our loans. It's really not that big of a deal. My parents are doctors. Like, they have lots of money. There was more of that talk. And then during residency, I talked to my co-residents about it too. And, I talked to my co-residents really about contributing to a Roth IRA because I'm like, look, right now we can contribute. We're a very low tax bracket. Once we're attending, we'll be paying a lot more taxes. Like this Roth money contributing now is so much more worthwhile. And I only got one of my co-residents ever to actually put any money into their Roth IRA. Everyone else was like, oh, but I need the money now. And, as a resident, you're actually making very much a middle class salary. Like I think I can't quite remember, but made around $55,000 a year, which I did my residency in downtown Chicago, so that really did not go very far. So I get it, but at the same time, like the average family of four in the United States at that time was somewhere around $60,000 to $65,000 a year. So as a resident, we were making as much as the average American family. And yes, I was living in a high cost of living city, but I was still contributing to my Roth IRA during residency. And it just means that, and I was still doing other things. I was still traveling internationally. Actually, traveling is my passion, and I've been able to do it consistently throughout my life. And that's because that I've put money towards that value. And so I also value financial freedom and independence. And in order to, so I mean, a lot of times people talk about retirement, planning for retirement, but what I really think about is investing for financial freedom.
I agree that it's critical to have try to integrate sound financial principles with having the life that you want now. Tomorrow isn't promised to anyone, so even though we want to provide for tomorrow, we also want to make sure that we're structuring our life so that we can make sure that we're not deferring all our happiness to some unknown future date. I wanted to ask you about with your travel and keeping that as a value. Was that something that you started being conscious about as a student, or was it something that you noticed more after you were budgeting as you moved into either residency or new attendinghood? And then did you do your fellowship immediately after residency? And so you were kind of in that same income bracket for a prolonged period of time, or did you actually practice and then return to additional training?
Yeah, so my love of travel actually started young. So my father is a professor, or was a professor, he's retired now. And he actually took a sabbatical year where the summer before and after his sabbatical year, he actually took us on a round trip, road trip around the country. And so we went and visited national parks around the United States, as well as family members throughout the country. And so that was my, I think, first real taste of like just exploration. And then I also got the chance to go to Vienna. So one of my really good childhood friends, her father was also a professor, and he got a Fulbright scholarship to teach in Vienna for a year. And so at the towards the end of the year, I actually they invited me to come out. And so I actually got to go to Europe. My parents put me on a plane by myself. I flew to Vienna and spent 2 weeks in Vienna, and my friend and I. So this happened the summer before high school, so between middle school and high school. And the two of us, we could go all around the city using public transportation, going to museums and palaces and cafes. And it was like I just fell in love with Europe at that point. And then I actually again got to go to England the summer after I graduated from high school, because there was someone else who her father worked for BP and had gotten transferred to Cleveland for a year. So she spent senior year with us. And so then her family went back. And so I got to go back and visit her and live with her family for 2 weeks outside London. And again, we went around to Stonehenge and Kew Gardens and Windsor Castle. And so that just really spurred my love of travel. And during undergrad, I managed to go to France for a week for spring break, and just from money that I had saved from working. And I went with my boyfriend, who's now my husband at the time. And we did hostels. We did very cheaply. We found really cheap tickets over a spring break. And so I've really just all through medical school, residency, fellowship, have always just found the money to travel. And I remember during medical school, so one of my best friend from high school, she actually works for United Nations. And so she's been stationed in countries around the world. And she was in Ecuador when I was in medical school. So I got to go with her to Ecuador. And I actually was asking around my friends from medical school if anyone would want to join me. And everyone was like, oh, you can't do that. That's like so expensive. And granted, the plane ticket was, fairly pricey. It was, I can't remember how much, but hundreds of dollars. But once you get to Ecuador, Ecuador is very cheap. I remember you could get a set meal with like a drink, a full plate of meat and vegetables and rice, and then a dessert for like $1 or $2.
Be sure to check out this interview's conclusion on the next episode of Relative Currency.
Thank you for listening to Relative Currency. Please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and other major podcast platforms.